think Senator Scheid is in another committee right now, and I think a lot of the committee members are on other committees as well. We're going to start with a there are two bills we're going to have for discussion. Only the second one is more for the Health Committee than the Commerce Committee, if people wanted to leave at that time on the Commerce Committee. But we're going to start with a federal health care reform briefing update, and recognizing a lot of members of the committee have seen parts of it, and so I'm not sure who's starting, Brian or April. Go ahead, if you can just go ahead, and I'm sure some members of the committee will have some questions as well.
On, can you guys hear me? Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. We are here to provide you a general overview of the immediate issues that are in the health reform law. For the record, April Todd Malmlev, I'm the state health economist and director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to start off just by giving you a brief overview of the impact of the bill in terms of cost, coverage, and financing. The cost of the law is roughly $938 billion over 10 years. It covers 32 of the 54 estimated uninsured, which is roughly 60% of the uninsured population. Of those covered, 24 million will end up in coverage through subsidies through the exchange. 16 million will be covered through the Medicaid expansions. And there will be a loss of coverage in the individual and group market by roughly 8 million people. Financing for the law comes from two separate sources, half from spending cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, and the other half from new tax provisions. In terms of Medicare and Medicaid, a large chunk of that portion, roughly $200 billion, comes from cuts in Medicare fee-for-service payments. And those equate to reductions in the annual productivity updates that providers get through through Medicare. Also, a large portion of this also comes from cuts to the Medicare Advantage program. And what happens with these cuts is it's a restructuring of how Medicare Advantage plans are paid. And in some respects, it's actually beneficial to Minnesota, as payments in the past to Medicare Advantage plans have been based on fee-for-service, historical fee-for-service payments, and Minnesota has historically been very efficient, and so our payment rates have been less than other states. How they are restructuring Medicare Advantage is that they are setting the payment rates to plans at 115% of fee-for-service for low-cost states, so states like Minnesota and other states in the Midwest, and setting it at 95% of fee-for-service rates for states that are higher-cost states. Those are the two main components of the Medicare and Medicaid spending cuts. There are also others included in there, including pharmaceutical discounts, Medicaid drug rebates that Mr. Augsburg will describe later, some reductions in disproportionate share hospital payments, and a small amount from payment reform that we'll be talking about later. The other half of the financing comes from tax provisions. A large portion, roughly $200 billion, comes from an increase in the Medicare FICA tax. And it's an increase of 0.9% on those individuals over making over $200,000 and families making over $250,000. In addition to this tax provision, there are others as well, including annual fees on insurers and pharmaceutical companies, a new medical device tax, a Cadillac tax, and that's the tax on high-cost health plans that was delayed to 2018, and also a whole host of other tax changes related to FSAs, HSAs, the tax deductibility of medical expenses, and a new tanning bed tax. All of the provisions in the law will be implemented over the next 10 years, but as of April 19th, a new office was established within the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, primarily to deal with the implementation of the private sector initiatives. And this new office is called the Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. Currently, there are four programs established within that office: the Office of Oversight, Office of Insurance Programs, Office of Consumer Support, and Office of Health Insurance Exchanges. As I mentioned, these are established to implement the private market reforms, but this office has also been instructed to work with CMS to ensure that there is coordination between the public and private market reforms within the bill. What has also been mentioned in the law is that the NAIC must also work on many of the provisions of the implementation of the private market reforms, and I will give it over to Mr. Munson-Ragala to cover that.
Thank you, Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Ragala from the Department of Commerce. The committee should have a copy of this spreadsheet, which lists the different subject matters that the NAIC is working on. The second line talks about what the NAIC's responsibility is to provide HHS. The third column reflects the working group at the NAIC that is working on this issue. And the last column reflects whether or not Minnesota is in one of the relevant committees.
They are being handed out right now. I'm sorry about that. So maybe you can wait just a second and continue on with it.
One subject matter that I assume the committee is probably interested in is the recommendation that the NAIC must provide HHS by June 1st on topics related both to rate applications, rate filings, and definitions of medical loss ratio. As you know, the bill contains elements, or I should say directions, on medical loss ratios for group plans and individual plans, and the NAIC has been charged with providing them feedback on the elements that are to be contained in those plans. In fact, as we're meeting here, there's a call going on right now in one of the NAIC working groups to talk about where do you include quality initiatives in cost or admin, and if so, how do you do that? If members are interested in following the deliberations with NAIC, one of the links will be provided to you on the very last page of our presentation is the website on the NAIC with all the relevant subgroups and committees. All of their meetings are public meetings, and all of their drafts are going to be contained on their website. So you can get a sense of the comments being provided by interested parties. We received comments from industry, from consumer groups, from other regulators. But the timetable is for the NAIC to provide its product to HHS by June 1st on the medical loss ratio.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Munson-Ragala, is the department passing along recommendations to these groups that are working out in Washington that are this reform committee on the medical loss ratios and the premium rate review? Do you have a position on that, and what are you telling or recommending to them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, we have not provided a position per se. We've served in the role of compiling the remarks of our fellow regulators. You may know Julia Phillips, our health actuary. She's leading the health application subgroup of the medical loss ratio working group. She's provided some comments. I know our Department of Health is talking about or thinking about also providing comments themselves to the HHS draft reg that's been out there for public comment. Public comments on the draft regs are due by May 12th. So health will be providing some technical comments relative to some of the measures, some of our experience with respect to compiling the data.
And then to follow up on that, in Minnesota right now we have a system where we don't break out the premium rates and look at individual data by HMOs or the insurers. We just look at aggregate data. Is that the same kind of mechanism you're recommending for the national care reform?
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, HHS has actually asked us those questions. At what level of aggregation do you need to do? For example, you could calculate a medical loss ratio on a national basis. And let's say a plan decided, well, we came up with 79 as our loss ratio. They could then cut each of their members across the country a check for 1% of premium. That would be one approach. Or they could do it, the opposite constraint would be to do it on an individual member basis. So in a given year, your loss ratio was 40%. So we had to cut each member, a refund in 40% of premium. I suspect the plans would prefer an approach at the higher level of aggregation. Our suspicion is that HHS will likely go in both markets. So individual has some characteristics different than group insurance and probably by state boundary. The challenge will be where a state is small enough that there's not enough credible data. I don't know how HHS is going to make some determinations there. But what we are doing right now is providing them information on the pros and cons of different levels of aggregation, different methods of counting or methodology, impact on potential premium, for example. Based on just their preliminary analysis, they would expect that most small group and large group insurers are likely to be able to meet the standards that HHS is going to promulgate, but that's very much an initial review. They think that on the individual side, there are going to be some carriers on the individual marketplace that are not likely to meet that standard.
Senator Olson and Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say, Mr. Munson-Ragala, that I'm concerned about the idea that the insurance commissioners as a group are going to be making the recommendations that are going to be determining how we determine what's included in the medical loss ratio analysis. My experience, and of course this is only Minnesota, and I know that insurance commissioners in other states have more or less consumer orientation, consumer protection orientation, depending perhaps on, you know, whatever their emphasis may be in that state. But there have been some things, I mean, just beginning with the fact that it's been very, very difficult to get from the department any kind of an idea what is an administrative cost and what isn't an administrative cost. In many of the committees that we've been on, it's just hard to even dig into this because it isn't analyzed. It doesn't seem to be a concern, or at least up to this point it hasn't been something that's really been tracked very well. There aren't standards that are tracking it uniformly. But we had someone from the Department of Commerce come to a committee and say that the Commerce Department had decided that an insurance company's cost of paying for reinsurance was a medical cost rather than an administrative cost, something that's designed to protect their risk. And so it seems like the Commerce Department hasn't been real active from a consumer protection standpoint in looking at some of these issues. And from the standpoint of the insurance industry, there are billions of dollars at stake here. So they're going to spend the money to make sure that their positions are represented. Consumers, on the other hand, while there are some consumer protection groups in this state, we don't really have a consumer protection stakeholder group that's looking at these issues as a whole and really kind of advocating, and it's hard to have the money to compete with the money that's being spent by the insurance industry. And so, you know, it was pointed out to me by a healthcare professional at a meeting that we had recently back in my district that the benefit of having this federal legislation on medical loss ratio is all going to be dependent on how we define this. And if we allow the insurance industry to basically set the parameters, it's going to be sort of meaningless. And so I'm really concerned that we have the medical community involved in this discussion, that we have some real meaningful consumer representation in this discussion, and that we actually do hold accountable individually, not just on an aggregate basis, each of the plans for how they are how much money is going toward care and how much money is being kept within their system, however they might justify the benefit of having that money available to them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure there's a question in your comments, but I will respond by saying the role of the NAIC was one that that was thrust upon us. It's part of the bill, so that's the first thing I would respond. Secondly, I think there seems to be some misunderstanding about when I talk about aggregation on a national level versus aggregation on an individual consumer level, how you calculate the medical loss ratio, not whether or not the plans will be ultimately responsible. And lastly, with respect to the Commerce Department's role with respect to consumer protection, I will tell you, for what it's worth, when several plans heard that our folks were on those committees, they, I would say audible groans were heard.
Mm-hmm. Good.
My folks have a reputation as being demonstrably tough on plans and what they can or can't do with respect to filing. Now, having said that, we do believe in uniformity. So to the extent that some of the definitional guidelines are contained in our annual statement blanks, which is where they are, we're going to live with those statements. And that's one of the things that I think you're going to see as part of this process is more transparency, more uniformity. And to the extent that other folks feel a need to weigh in, there is obviously that possibility through the public comment process. So that's all I can say with respect to, you know, the role we're playing and how it's perceived as to whether or not we're doing right by the consumer. I will say that industry groups are not especially delighted that we're part of the process.
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I guess I may have a different impression or a different experience based on a lot of things that I won't go into. So I'll just ask you a very specific question. How is it the Department of Commerce can consider the cost of reinsurance to be a medical cost as opposed to an administrative cost?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think you'll have to ask our Chief Financial Examiner, Jackie Gardner, that question. But my suspicion, and this is only a suspicion, is that it's part of our uniform annual statement blank filing process. So in other words, when companies file their annual statements every year, which they're doing right now, we get nice big yellow books that show, you know, their losses, their investments, their expenses. They're given detailed instructions on how to do that. Those instructions are the same from state to state. My guess is that's where reinsurance falls into that bucket.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Wilson.
Actually, we did ask that question of, I assume it was that person because she was there to represent the Department of Commerce in quite a bit of detail. And our understanding from this is a conversation that occurred a couple of years ago, so I can't quote it verbatim, but it sounded as though this was a judgment call that this Department of Commerce had made.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I will follow up with the committee and get confirmation on how we or where we include the cost of reinsurance. And I will confirm, you know, how we do that and what's the basis for our doing so.
Well,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Munson-McGowan, while you're doing that, I would appreciate it if we could get a breakdown, which we've still never been able to really get, with regard to all administrative costs or costs generally, and how you determine which ones go into how the equation is separated as far as different kinds of costs. And whether, you know, if you have the standards, then we'd still like to see them. We've been asking for that now for 4 years. If not, then it's just the insurance companies making that determination, and Commerce isn't doing much in the way of overseeing. So we need to know which it is, and we'd really like to see that breakdown.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we'd be glad to do that. I'll just warn you that the annual statement blanks, as Senator Marty knows, are fairly extensive. We'll provide that material to you, and we'll be glad to take some time to work with you through that process. Our only caveat is that some of the folks you're going to need to work through that process are also working on some of the working groups now, so they might have a little bit of limited availability until the 1st. We'll try to accommodate your desires, but we'll try to get you that material as soon as possible.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize because I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but it's because I have to leave to go to a Finance Committee meeting. So my question is for Deputy Commissioner Munson-Regala, and I'm wondering if you can explain to us why the governor has opted not to have Minnesota join the temporary high-risk pool that the federal government has established for people who are uninsurable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, be glad to. I also understand that you might have some time limitations, we're also going to have an informational hearing on this in Commerce tomorrow to cover the high-risk pool and its impact on Minnesota. In a nutshell, the governor's concern was financial, that the sum allocated for Minnesota, the $68 million over the length of the program, did not give him comfort that that was going to be sufficient to meet the perceived needs of the folks who would access the high-risk pool program.
Well, Deputy Commissioner, don't we have a high-risk pool that those people would be in if they're not in a federal pool?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's correct. So
it would seem to me that anybody that could be in the federal pool for however long that could happen would take some pressure off of the high-risk pool that we have to fund at the state level.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brigham, that was one of the pros and cons we shared with the governor. Countervailing those pros and cons were the concerns from the high-risk pool themselves about administering a program that differed both in premium and benefit design than the plan they were administering. They shared with us a number of concerns relative to those, both to the operational risk. The plan has to be enrolling, the federal plan, by July 1st. That's not a lot of time to set up a new pool. And we need to be clear, we can't just use the money to defer the cost of our existing pool.
I understand that, but I guess maybe we'll get more information tomorrow, but I don't understand a high-risk pool that exists, why it would be so hard for them to administer another pool that would have slightly different premiums and slightly different eligibility criteria.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brigham, I do know one of the other concerns the high-risk pool had, and to the extent it waited in the governor's deliberations, I don't know, was that, to get to your point, the fact that there were going to be two different pools, there was going to be some inequity between those two pools. The federal pool was going to be at 100% of standard. The existing pool is at 120, going to go to 122. One of the concerns the high-risk pool had was, how do you explain to existing members, if you want to access this federal program, you've got to go naked for 6 months? That was one of the concerns they had in terms of how to do this correctly.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Deputy Commissioner, it doesn't seem to me that that is that difficult of an issue. There is an opportunity for people to make choices, and when they make choices, they have to consider what would be best for them. There are people that join our high-risk pool that we have in Minnesota today that haven't been enrolled in anything for 6 months when they show up at our door. Those people could certainly be given the opportunity to enroll in the federal high-risk pool and perhaps to have a better benefit set or better premiums.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, to get to your point, the governor's decision doesn't foreclose their ability to join the high-risk pool. The governor's decision was who gets to administer that money. HHS is going to still administer a pool in our state, and we're going to work with them to be sure that folks know all their options. So the governor's decision wasn't to say no to the money. It was no to being responsible for managing that sum. So, to the extent that folks are confused about what the decision means, it's not to say no to the money. It's no to who gets to manage the program.
Mr. Chairman and Deputy Commissioner, that does help clarify a little bit, but then I'm a bit befuddled to know how Minnesotans are going to know that they have a federal pool that they could opt into.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, you are jumping ahead because there
I am not Senator Olson.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Senator Brigham, my apologies. We have part of our slides will talk about our communication process, both on the high-risk pool and on other elements of the federal program, how we plan on sharing that information with Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just one last question. Will the high-risk pool that we have in Minnesota give people information when they call to ask about our high-risk pool compared to the federal high-risk pool? Because that's who they're going to call. That's who people are used to telling them to call.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brigham, I believe they will. We will work with them. I'm looking at their lobbyist right now. She's nodding. I think we can provide the appropriate links on their website, on our website, and that's what we're going to talk about, eventually a state of Minnesota health reform website. So we'll have a number of different places where folks are going to be able to get the information.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to summarize then, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesotans will have access to the federal temporary high-risk pool, and our MSHA program will be providing potential enrollees information as to how to access that pool. Is that correct? Is that what you just said to me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brigham, that's correct.
Thank you.
And this is going to be discussed in Commerce tomorrow? Okay. Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mensah-Margolla. And I'm very glad that, as long as we're on that topic, that Senator Brigham was able to clarify that the governor is not going to turn away $6 to $8 million of federal money that could be used to help pay for these premiums, because I thought I heard in the newspaper that he was going to do that. So I'm glad he's not planning to do that. And I also wanted to say that with regard to Senator Berglund's comments about offering consumers choices, we had a presentation that where we earlier in Senator Berglund's committee where it was described that this these are not a sub one plan is not a substitute for the other. Even if we opt into this federal plan, as now I'm understanding you to say we are going to do, we will then, because otherwise we don't get the money. We can't just take the money into our existing plan, according to what we were told, because there are parameters that are requirements if you want to do that. For example, the rates are going to be lower, and the coverage is going to be better, but you have the six-month waiting period. So that's kind of the choice that people would have to make. And getting to my point about worrying about consumers, I heard you say something about the health plans aren't going to like it if it's not competitive because people are going to be paying less and that's not a fair playing field. Maybe I'm misinterpreting what you said, but I thought that's what I heard you say, and then that kind of brings me back to my point.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, my apologies for any confusion.
Okay.
The MCHA board, one of the concerns they articulated to us, and we'll be glad to expand on this tomorrow, was the inequity they perceived between the 27,000, 30,000 people they're taking care of today who saved the money to pay 120% of standard in order to keep them or, and their family insured versus the folks who by happenstance and luck were eligible for this federal pool. They didn't want to be in a position of having to explain to their current members, we're administering another pool over here that's cheaper with potentially better coverage, but you can't get at it unless you go naked and take a chance you don't have a loss during that six-month window. That was one of their concerns they raised with us as to why they didn't want to administer the program. Having said that, to get to your point, those folks who are eligible for the federal program can still get there. The fact that we as a state aren't running that federal program doesn't impair the ability for other folks to get to that program.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Munson-Ragala, I understand that it's not just the state, but there are nonprofits or others who could run a program like this. Who's going to run it in Minnesota then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we've checked with HHS if they've gotten that far yet. They're still thinking through their options. They do have the contract with a nonprofit to administer the federal program, and that will be a pool of roughly 20 states have decided that the feds can run the program for them. And we say roughly 20 because we're not sure about the intentions of two states. I think their letter was sort of, we need more information kind of letter. So they'll make a decision about how to run that program in their states. I know we've shared with them information that there are nonprofit plans in our state that may or may not be interested in administering just the federal pool. I know that there are some regional nonprofits that might express some interest, and again, administering the regional pool. One of the decision points, I assume, for some states was the fact that in their state, the likely number of enrollees was so small that it made more sense to aggregate them in a larger regional or national pool for administrative expense, for some ease of getting the program up and running. I don't know how much of that was part of the governor's equation. I do know when we did some of the analysis, and again, we can go into more detail about this tomorrow, we were looking at maybe 1,200 to 1,900 people in Minnesota that we thought would likely access this federal pool.
I think we'd like to move on now because we're going to have this discussed in Commerce Committee tomorrow. So please continue where you were.
Another immediate change that, and we've talked about this, some of the members, plan years effective on or after 6 months post-enactment, that's roughly September 23rd, we'll no longer be able to have lifetime benefit limits, restricted annual benefit limits, dependent coverage to age 26, we're at currently 25, coverage of prevention services, and there's a definition for what that means without cost sharing, no pre-ex for kids, no rescissions except in cases of fraud. Commerce and Health have been meeting with the health plans on how they plan on complying with these provisions, particularly with respect to the rate and form filing aspects of these provisions, our likely plan is we will promulgate a mandatory endorsement that each plan will adopt so that they can get to the effective date and be in compliance in September. Then as we get more detail from HHS on what each of these benefit designs require, then I would imagine plans will then make more specific plan filings as they get more information.
Mr. Munson-Regala, with these requirements for the plans, does that include the ERISA plans? Does it include government? Does it include?
They apply to fully insured and self-funded plans. They apply to fully insured and self-funded plans, all plans.
Public plans, everybody, okay.
I believe there's an exception for our SIGA plan because I think we have to wait until it comes up again for the bargain when the contract runs out.
So, and that'll be true of any of the public plans, like school district plans and everything, that would be when they re-bargain?
There's still a little uncertainty in terms of when that would be effective. The law says that it's effective on or after 6 months post-enactment. However, there are some plans out there that are like a two-year contract, and so it's uncertain if that would be like a renewal year, so like next January, if that would happen to be the case, or if it's at the end of a contract, a two-year contract period. I think that's still a little unclear at this point.
Okay.
Sure, the other wild card you want to have in mind is that there's a grandfathering provision in PAPACA, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. If you like your existing plan and it doesn't include some of these provisions, you may have the ability to insist on keeping your existing plan. So that is the wild card.
So in other words, somebody like dependent coverage to 26 or no pre-existing condition, if your plan doesn't cover that, somebody's going to choose to keep a plan that doesn't?
There might be some cost savings associated with not picking up a richer plan. It might be material enough for some people.
The individual member would decide that, or if it's a collectively bargained thing, the collective bargaining?
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, if it's well, that's a good question. I think the grandfathering language is going to be discussing how they're going to handle collectively bargained agreements. I don't think the individual member in that case where your employer is providing coverage is going to have that option.
That would be pretty hard to do that.
But if it was an individual plan, Mr. Chair, then the individual member would be able to make that choice. We're going to quickly blitz through some of these other items. Another 2011, we're talking about the medical loss ratio. We've already had that conversation. There's going to be some changes in 2014. We just list them for you here so you know a little bit about where we're going. I know Mr. Osberg will talk later about what we're doing from a working group interagency to provide you guys with options. But our plan is to provide the legislature before the next session with here are all of the decisions you guys have to make with respect to enacting legislation next year.
Move on to the next slide. One of the provisions in the law establishes a health insurance exchange, and I know some of us, you guys have already know, is that the exchange starts in 2014. However, there is a provision in the law which is somewhat of a precursor to the exchange that starts in 2010. And actually, effective July 2010, HHS with states is to establish an internet portal to help consumers identify coverage options. Within this portal, information is to be provided for essentially all plans, so individual and group plans, Medicaid, CHIP, and high-risk pools. By June 2010, HHS is to develop a format to allow for comparison of these options, including medical loss ratio, eligibility, availability, premium rates, and cost sharing. Just recently, actually, as of yesterday, the Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight provided some information on how it is that that office is going to be establishing this portal. And what they've done is they've promulgated an initial rule that would require some information from insurers and the state. In particular, by May 21st, insurers must provide information, general information on eligibility criteria, summary information on services, provider networks, formularies, that type of thing to HHS. That is by May 21st, and HHS will be providing that information through the portal as of July 2010. There's a secondary step which would start in October of 2010, and the more detailed information around benefits and pricing for those particular plans would be available at that time.
Please, Senator Erickson-Rupes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the June 2010 bullet. We're talking about format, excuse me, for comparing the MLR and the eligibility. That's some of the information we've been trying to get to here in the state, and it seems to me, I know Dr. Golden is here, but at the last meeting we had, we were talking about whether or not that information is already available, and I think I remember him saying it's available but not reported. So how does that factor into what your recommendation is going to be for the feds, and are we going to be able to separate out that information again? So we're looking at pure data. We want to get non-commingled data. We want to track individual vendors, you know, things like that. And then on the MLR, are you going to be breaking out administrative costs and profit as a way to calculate the medical loss ratio?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the Department of Health does collect information from plans separately from what Commerce does on medical expenditures and administrative costs, and partially we do that to allow us to estimate and project healthcare spending in the state. We do collect that information separately for each plan in the state, and we do also collect it by product line. We collect general information on medical expenditures and administrative costs by product line. That information is available. We do do a 21-day review with the plans to provide that information on an individual plan level and instead of doing it on an aggregate level, which we can do today. In terms of...
So just to clarify, Mr. Chair, that 21-day period you're talking about, is that to go over with them what you're about to report, to clarify and verify with them before it goes public, or is it to get the information from them?
Senator Erickson-Rupes, the 21-day period is actually, they send us information on their expenditures, and we have an auditing program that we go through to ensure that the data makes sense and that it's adding and summing and all of that type of information. Once we have done that, we provide the information back to them after various conversations, and that's the 21-day review for them to review the information, make sure it's final, and that they don't have any modifications to the data that's in that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says that effective 2014, the states are to establish an exchange. And I guess maybe this is, well, to me it's an important difference in looking at timelines. I thought the way this was presented initially, that was a deadline, and that the states could certainly do establish an exchange at any point between now and 2014 going forward, so that this isn't like when it actually is effective the way it makes it seem here. That's the deadline, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. By January 1st, 2013, the states need to report to HHS on their progress towards creation of an exchange so that HHS can determine whether or not they will need to gear up to run an exchange for that particular state.
But, Mr. Chair, we could certainly have an exchange up and running by 2011 or 2012 if the state decided to move forward in that direction. That these are deadlines, right? And so with that in mind, I guess I'd wonder, what is your department's plan in terms of creating an exchange as far as a time frame? Are you looking at taking as long as possible and only doing this by the time that we meet the deadline, or how soon are you planning to move forward with this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, a variety of agencies. So our interagency group is looking at the provisions that are in the law related to the exchange. There are many provisions that don't yet have details or have rules or regs around them, so there are many things that we are unclear as to what the requirements will be, what the options are, and what the open questions are that we may want to consider as a state. What we are doing as an interagency group at the moment is looking through what we think are the requirements, what we think are the options, what are the open questions, and what potentially the options are for setting up the exchange, as there are many different ways that you could set one up, and also considering what the impact would be on the outside market of those various options, so that we can think through this strategically in terms of what are the different ways that we can do this, present that to the legislature, governor, others, stakeholders, so that we can have a thoughtful discussion around what the different options are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, one of the tasks the NAIC has been charged with is providing some initial recommendations for HHS so that HHS can promulgate their regs that we will then react to. Minnesota is on the working group at the NAIC on providing recommendations to HHS on what should be contained in those exchange regs. Minnesota is also on the working group dealing with interstate compacts, because HHS is, again, looking for the NAIC to provide some direction, guidance, recommendations on what you do relative to the creation of interstate compacts. For example, let's say an option for Minnesota would be to enter into a regional exchange with the Dakotas, Wisconsin, Iowa. One of the ways you could accomplish that would be through language through an interstate compact. So there might be some synergy there between the two provisions. I think we're interested in trying to preserve as many options for Minnesota as possible, so that the policymakers yourselves can make a determination what kind of an exchange you want to set up, whether it's regional, state-based, run by the state, run by a nonprofit. There are different ways you can do get to a regional exchange, to any exchange.
Please proceed.
I'm going to go past the exchange since we were talking about that a little bit and cover some other provisions in the bill. There are also provisions in the law related to payment reform and care coordination. As I was mentioning earlier, the CBO has not estimated a large chunk of savings related to payment reform and care coordination in the law, primarily because many of the things that are in the law are pilot programs and demonstration projects. And so at this point, they can't bank on what those savings would be until they evaluate the effectiveness of those pilots and demonstrations. Of interest to Minnesota is CMS is going to be establishing a new innovation center in 2011. And this innovation center is set up to test and expand Medicare and Medicaid payment models, including state all-payer models and other state proposals such as accountable care organizations and global payment. Some of the demonstration projects, I've only listed a few of them here. There are numerous opportunities for pilots and demonstration projects listed in the bill, as well as a state can also propose a different type of model. Some of these I'm not going to go over because Mr. Osberg will be covering some of these in detail later. But just to give you an update on where this stands, the NAIC has established a cost containment committee as part of that list of committees that is looking at various provisions in the law. This committee does not have the authority or has not been asked to provide rules or regs in any type of way around payment reform, but they are organizing the committee as a way for states to talk with each other around cost containment initiatives and potential interest in pilot programs. And so we may be interested in that type of participation with other states to figure out what they are also interested in. The process, however, for state involvement in these payment reform pilots and demonstration projects is not clear at this point. We have not received any information from HHS in terms of what that process will be. The law also includes the creation of a national quality strategy. And this is to start in 2010, where federal agencies are to coordinate and streamline the quality activities that are happening amongst various federal agencies. This group will identify gaps in quality measurement and look to collect, aggregate, and report on quality measures and resource use. They will also be working with stakeholders to develop quality measures for use in federal programs, Medicare and Medicaid, and they have been specifically instructed to develop and report on 10 quality measures for acute and chronic care and 10 measures for primary and preventive care for physicians and hospitals by 2012. Again, the process for doing this and for stakeholder involvement, including states, is not clear at this point. We have not heard anything from HHS in terms of that process. Other provisions in the law that are of interest to us, one is related to prevention and public health. There is a national prevention strategy that will also be established. And there's a new $13 billion trust fund that is set up to expand and sustain funding for prevention and public health programs. And grants to states are to start in 2010. However, within the law, the grants that are to states, there's no specific dollar amount that has been appropriated for those specific grants. The law just mentions funds as may be necessary have been authorized. So there's no direct appropriation. No guidance has been released from HHS to date. What I have listed here is just a couple of the examples. You will see in the table that we have given you that you should have received already is a much broader list of some of those grants that could be available for funding under this trust fund.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Chair, one of the bills that we're going to hear later on during this meeting deals with this prevention trust fund or some of the money that's available through the federal grant to states that are expanding capacity and that sort of thing. So just want to point that out.
Some other issues that are of interest to public health include some workforce provisions. There's also a National Workforce Commission that is established. And in 2010, states may apply for a competitive grant to carry out workforce, to establish workforce development strategies. And also in 2010, there are a variety of loan and grant programs. The entirety of Title 10 of this law deals with new federal loan and grant programs to increase the supply of healthcare and the public health workforce. And there are also provisions related to nursing homes and long-term care. Many of these provisions modify current federal compliance requirements, for example, around a standardized complaint form, civil monetary penalties, some oversight of intrastate and interstate nursing home chains, and around conducting background checks. Many of these things the state of Minnesota already does, and so we may already be in compliance, but the federal rules and regs have not yet been released. So this it may impact us in some way in terms of how we currently do what we do. We have, however, started initial discussions with CMS to get a sense of how this may impact what we currently do in the state. I'll give it over to Mr. Osberg.
Thank you, Ms. Todd-Malma. Mr. Osberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brian Osberg. I'm the State Medicaid Director at the Department of Human Services. And on the Medicaid reform piece, most of the reform takes place in 2014. But the states have an option to adopt earlier a Medicaid arrangement for parents and adults up to 133% of the federal poverty guideline. We cover parents up to 275% today, but we do not, through Medicaid, cover adults without kids. So we ask the question is whether or not we can convert our current or the GAMC program or one of our Minnesota Care program for adults without kids into Medicaid. The answer was no. And primarily because we cannot have an asset test. We were wondering whether or not they would allow an asset test until 2014, where it clearly would not be permitted. They said no to that. So this requires us to develop a new program. Now, we have just sent a letter to the chairs, Senator Berglund and Representative Huntley, a notice that we can put together a new program by combining the GAMC program and medical assistance for parents into one program in a temporary and interim basis as early as July 1st, if something passes by May 17th. Otherwise, we're encouraging that if we want to do this right, but that limits us in terms of what we can do in this program. For example, it requires us then to cover long-term care services for this population, which we don't necessarily want to do because it's more expensive. It will not necessarily be needed for that population. So to do it correctly with high quality, we like to have until January 1st. However, we have said that we can bundle these two existing programs into one new program by July 1st if indeed something is enacted by May 17th. And the next graph, in terms of financing issues, one of the conditions in this legislation is that the states have a maintenance of effort requirement. For example, we cannot change eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures. That means the legislature is going to have to buy back. We're going to have to buy back some of the provisions that were enacted last year. We've indicated to the two finance committees what provisions we have to change in order to meet this maintenance of effort requirement. because the last maintenance of effort requirement from last year went through this calendar year. Now, this extends maintenance of effort provisions until 2014 for adults, not just for parents and adults without kids, but also for people with disabilities and for seniors, and until 2019 for children. Now, the sole exemption is this, is that if...
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, I just have one quick question on the first bullet point. Just to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, when it's talking about the states may not change eligibility standards, does that direction have to do with patients and not the vendors or the providers or the health plans? So when it's talking about not changing methodologies, procedures, standards, it addresses the patients and not the payers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Robes, yes, it addresses the eligibility of the clients. In terms of their eligibility, like income or the level of care determination for long-term care or premiums. That's another example of a maintenance of effort requirement, but it does not relate to the delivery of care necessarily.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So good. So if the state wants to move forward with changes related to payer profitability or number of vendors or things like that, that is not precluded by this law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, yes, payment to providers is not included in this maintenance of effort.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you for allowing me to participate. So when you're talking about eligibility standards, and you said that we would have to go back to another year, you said we have to go back. So, for example, if we said that in order to be eligible for long-term care, you have to meet 3 of 5 standards, and we had raised that from 2 to 3, that we'd have to go back to the 2.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Sharon, yes, that's true. We would have to go back to the 2, back to where we were prior to last year's change.
Prior to last year's, okay.
And then the only exception to this maintenance of effort requirement is that if the state can demonstrate that we're in a deficit situation, which unfortunately, as you know, we can, and that we could possibly affect eligibility for parents above 133% to 275. We have that option. Also, there's no increase in local portion of non-federal share. In other words, we can't ask the counties to participate in addition to what they do today in terms of financing our Medicaid programs. And it varies by Medicaid program as to what level of financing counties have currently. In large part, for our health care programs in Medicaid, for example, there's no county participation, but in mental health there is today. So we can't change it. We can't increase county share for our Medicaid programs. The next point is the loss of rebates. This is going to be a short-term hit. The federal government is going to recapture rebates, state share of pharmacy rebates between 15% and 23% of what's called AMP, average manufacturer price. We think this is going to be probably, we don't know exactly the number yet because they haven't given us all the specifics that we need, and this will not be reflected in this year's budget, but it'll probably be reflected in next year's forecast, in November's forecast. And it could be in the millions, less than $10 million, but in the millions of an impact. This is one of the ways in which they're financing the reform legislation. Another point is that, good news, is that they're increasing federal financing for our CHIP program, which is right now about $48 million, but it's still going from 50 or 65% federal match to 88% federal match from 2013-2019. That helps. Then there's 100% federal match for primary care rate increases for our program. We know our primary care rates are low, especially compared to other states for our program. And this allows the federal government for 2 years will pay 100% of the difference where we are today and up to the Medicare primary care rates. But after that, it goes back to a regular federal match. So we have to figure out after 2014 how we finance that, or when that we would change those rates. And then the last thing is that 90% federal match for healthcare home services, which we have in place. So we'll be ready by January of 2011 to take advantage of this. Now, this is just for the coordination fees, not for the services related to the healthcare home. That would be nice. That'd be great if we could get 90% match for all the services provided by our healthcare home. We're just talking about the fee that we pay to the healthcare home, and gets 90% match. But we'll be ready in 2011, and the budget bills have reflected the savings already.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Osberg, this backs up a little bit, but you're the Medicaid guru, so I wonder, we were talking a little bit earlier about the value-based purchasing for Medicare providers, Medicare providers, and how those payments are tied to quality indicators, which is a really good way to go. Everybody wants to go that direction. Are you giving any thought to value-based purchasing for Medicare the health plans, people dealing with the Medicaid, for like the PMAP vendors? I mean, I think that's an area we just skip over. Is there a reason that we couldn't look at some goals and high-quality measures for that segment of people who receive state money and use the same kind of value-based purchasing strategy for the PMAP vendors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, exactly. In fact, we'd already do that in the managed care arrangements. We have a withhold with them. They have to meet certain quality measures. They also have an incentive to meet certain quality measures. And we want to do that. In fact, based on the 2008 legislation, reform legislation, there are going to be quality measures and efficiency measures. And we'll determine payment based on those measures as provided in state law. So we're already ahead of the game on that. In fact, what we want to do is have Medicare participate in the same model that we have. And we're going to ask Medicare to do that. We're going to ask Medicare to join us. Instead of Medicare having a different method of doing things, join us in how we are measuring and rewarding quality and efficiency. So that's what we're going to do going forward. We're not going to wait for these demonstration projects to be set up. We've already asked CMS to consider the possibility of joining us now to do value-based purchasing, not only for managed care organizations, but also providers directly. That's the point of the next slide. The fourth dot point is that we allow states to participate in payment reform demonstrations, and we intend to do that very thing. And also in a pediatric accountable care organization. That's what an ACO is an accountable care organization demonstration. Also requires coverage of freestanding birthing centers, effective July 2011. There's legislation being considered now that would do that January 2011. But will be required by July 2011 in Medicaid, and strengthens the hospice coverage for children. And also, the last point, it strengthens program integrity efforts around to prevent and detect fraud and abuse around Medicaid providers and insurance market. So it certainly provides a lot of more tools to do that as well. Next slide is regarding long-term care. There's incentives provided in the legislation to do more home and community-based services as opposed to institutional services. Minnesota already does a good job of that compared to other states. So we're already ahead of the game on that. And then the last dot point there suggests that this is a public option for long-term care insurance. It's called the CLASS Act. At the beginning in 2012, everyone's payroll would be deducted to buy into a federal long-term care insurance program unless people opt out of that. It'll be voluntary, but it'll be provided automatically unless people opt out of that coverage. And Minnesota is one of the leading states in terms of take-up for long-term care insurance. We developed a long-term care partnership program which tries to protect assets when somebody is heading towards Medicaid. And this will, we think, strengthen potentially ability for us to do that and encourage people to buy coverage, long-term care coverage.
Can I?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, since some people are about to, maybe within 5 years of going into or needing that coverage, and other people might be 50 years away from it, and everyone's going to have to pay, are they just going to... Are the rates going to be determined like they would be if you were going out in the private market, where you're going to pay a lot more if you're closer to, if you're going to be paying in for a lesser time, or don't we know yet how that program is going to be set up?
Chairman, Senator Olson, we really don't know all the specifics yet. There's some provisions in there. It tells us what they may look like, but there's a lot to be done. Another question is, somebody's asked, is what happens if you're not working for an employer? Do you have the option to buy into this as well? That's another question that's not been answered, and I'm not sure, Deputy Commissioner, whether or not you have any other points or information regarding that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, we're tracking the same questions, too, because we're trying to figure out how that's going to interface with the private long-term care insurance folks are purchasing. I know that one of the resources we give you is the National Governors Association Healthcare Reform website. That's another good place to get some of this aggregated data or information. One of the subgroups they're going to be setting up is going to be looking at sort of how do you manage those tail kind of questions. But I don't. We're still at the point where we can't give you much advice right now.
And Mr. Chairman, the last slide is regarding our agency, interagency effort. We have established, under the direction of the Governor's Health Cabinet, an interagency work group. As you see here, it consists of six agencies. And we have focused early on a couple of things. One is communications subgroup to look at, as we talked about earlier, a web portal to get information out to the public, but also how we're going to explain all this to Minnesotans over the next 6 months as to what exactly this is all about. And so it's communications not only with the public but with other stakeholders. And then we're also going to have a insurance exchange subgroup that Deputy Commissioner and April Todd Malbov are going to be co-chairing in terms of working through the issues relating to the insurance exchange. And then we're starting already our stakeholder engagement. We have an ongoing discussion with the health plans, and we intend to do the same thing with other stakeholders. What we want to do with this is making sure that we build off of our 2008 reform legislation. That's one of our tasks that we have is to leverage the federal reform to continue our state healthcare reform agenda. And we also want to continue to work with the legislature, and we need over time to understand how best to interact with the legislature relating to this activity over the next 6 months. Because we intend to, by this fall, have a comprehensive set of analyses and options for the next administration and the next legislature. So that's something, the work that we'll be doing over the next 6 months. And we certainly want to engage the legislature in that process. And then the last page is, as communicated, some good sites, websites, as to you can find more about this reform legislation.
Mr. Chair, our plan with respect, for example, to the Minnesota-specific health reform website is right now it's housed on Commerce's site. We'll eventually house it on the Department of Health servers. We've reserved a number of URLs. We'll let you know what we end up being able to use. This is a very fluid conversation. Our slides were outdated the minute we sent them to you. For example, today, right before we came over here, HHS promulgated a temporary reg on the retiree reinsurance program. So we're going to share that information with you after we get done with some analysis. But we would recommend that you go to these websites. They're kept up to date fairly regularly. The one on the National Governors Association, if you go to our website and click on the URL, the tiny URL, that will bring you to the Governors Association's health reform website. But if that doesn't work, if you go to their homepage, they have a tab for healthcare reform that you can get to also. The National Governors Association is trying to coordinate the efforts or get information from the NCSL, the NAIC, and
National Association of State Health Policy, which has a very good summary of long-term care provisions. It's a national association. Again, going to the NGA site, they can link to other sites. And plus the National Association of State Medicaid Directors is part of that link as well. That's probably the most comprehensive one site to go to.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Osberg or Mr. Munson-Regala or Ms. Todd-Mola? Senator Sharon.
I missed the first part, so I just wanted to check on one. When they're talking about small businesses, You're talking about small businesses being 100 employees, you know, or states can reduce that to 50. I was reading that somewhere in here. Have they defined whether or not that is, what is an employee? Is it a full-time employee equivalent, or how does a company that hires students or hires part-time employees deal with this legislation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I would say it's not exactly a clear answer at this point. There is language throughout the law that specifies that an employee is a full-time employee at around 30 hours a week. There are also provisions in the law that that do make some modifications of what's considered full-time for those employers that are seasonal, for example, that those employees that, for example, that would work 30 hours a week for 6 months of the year for seasonal business, that would also be considered full-time for that part of the year. There is a section of the law that's very detailed in that respect, and we can get you more information on that if you'd like that.
And then just a follow-up, if that's okay, Senator Marty. So within the law, if the employee's part-time or has a series of part-time jobs, they won't be covered through a small business, and the small business won't be paying a fee if they're on a public program or on a program on the exchange. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I don't know that I would say that is particularly correct. It's just in terms of the definition for a lot of the things regarding small group, for example, for like the small employer credits and classification of what is a small group. Those are the types of definitions, but it does not necessarily impact the employee's ability to be in the exchange.
So those employees that are not covered by an employer under those terms would get the tax credits. If they're not eligible for a public program, they would get the tax credits or the assistance to be able to purchase on the exchange. Is that where they would fall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, there are some, it depends on the employers. So small employers that do not offer coverage or don't offer it to their part-time employees could get coverage through the exchange and get that subsidy. For larger employers, so those over 50, if they don't offer coverage or if they don't offer coverage to their part-time employees, if those employees do get subsidies through the exchange, there is a penalty that's assessed to those employers. It ranges between $2,000 to $3,000 per full-time equivalent employee, so the hours that are calculated there. So there is a little bit of difference in treatment based on the size of employer for the exchange.
Just one more, because I want to make sure I understand this. I get a lot of questions about this. You're saying full-time equivalent hours, so it's a cumulative hours of all the employees? Or if you have a bunch of part-time employees, the company still is going to be assessed if they're on as a part-time employee, or is it for the full-time employee?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, there's a different calculation that's put in place for the calculation of the penalty for those employers that have over 50 full-time employees. It's a little complicated, is what I would say.
I'm not quite clear yet how that's being treated, because when you're talking about a penalty for employees, full-time employees, I understand that. It's defined as 30 hours. But what if they are working 10 hours or 20 hours and are an employee very part-time, year-round, like somebody that's a caretaker for a housing project?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I would say those people would be eligible for those subsidies. It's just the differences in how the employer is treated in terms of the penalty, so in what bucket they would be in, whether or not they would be assessed the penalty or not. So say, for example, there is an employer that has 45 45 full-time employees and 5 part-time employees, but those 5 part-time employees aren't exactly together in terms of hours, wouldn't get up to that 50, then that employer would not be assessed those penalties if those employees got subsidies in the exchange.
We'll talk further later.
Beyond.
Did you get that?
No. The longer you talk, the worse it gets.
That's what worries me about the whole thing. I mean, everything in this, the definitions and everything. I had one quick question, and you may not be the right one to know, but when they, on your first or second page in the talking about coverage, we're this package will cover 32 of 54 million uninsured, and you explain where they all come from, the 40 million increase and the loss of eight. When I look at the drop in employer-sponsored health care in the last few years, and I know they have some reason not to drop now, but when I look at how many people have been losing their coverage in the last few years just in Minnesota, it seems to me that over a 10-year period, if any of the health care costs keep going up any way the way they are, that we might have a loss of not 8 million, but loss of 30 or 40 million. In other words, that we're treading water. We're putting all this work into covering more people, but more people are falling out the other end. Is that 8 million assumption, in other words, that, or plus the population from 300 million to what the population is 10 years from now, I don't know, but is that 8 million their best estimate because nobody's going to be dropping coverage anymore because employers won't be able to afford the penalty, or is that who made that assumption, the Congressional Budget Office, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, these are the estimates of the Congressional Budget Office, and if you look through their estimate as of March 20th, which is the final estimate of the bill, it includes a variety of, it's their attempt to put a variety of those provisions together. So, for example, today there's 54 million are not uninsured today, but that is what the likely estimate would be in 2019, would be the 54 million. So they are building that in there. And they have also tried to do some analysis of what the increase in cost would be. There are other analyses out there as well. For example, the Office of the CMS Actuary has also done some similar estimates that are in some ways similar, in some ways a little different from what the CBO has come up with. But in terms of the impact on coverage, they appear to be fairly similar.
So nobody is estimating loss of more than, I mean, CMS may be estimated 10 million or something. It's the same ballpark. Nobody's estimating 20, 30, 40 million more.
Correct.
Any further questions for them? If not, thank you very much for your report, and some of us will see you tomorrow in Commerce on the high risk thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Munson-Rigal is looking forward to tomorrow again. Senator Olson, you had a bill that I think both committees might have interest in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I should ask Senator Erickson Robes to come to the table with me because, you know, whenever we introduce a bill, one person has to be named as an author, but this really was both our bill, and we worked on it co-chairing the committee. So
just go ahead. Senator Olson, there won't be anyone on this side of the table if I leave. So.
There's more representation from Commerce. Actually, when you count back, the three of us are on both committees.
I guess I'm not.
Senate File 3369, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that I reintroduced after learning about some of the provisions related to the health care exchange that are in the federal health care reform bill. That's why it was a late introduction. And but it's a reintroduction with a couple of changes of a bill that Senator Erickson Ropes and I worked on the first year we were here, so I guess 4 years ago now. The concept for that original bill was the idea that if we allowed individuals and small businesses, or really anyone in the state, to be able to take part in a pool like some of our larger businesses can do and other groups can do, that pooling allows for efficiencies that help to bring down costs. It gives you more buying power, administrative efficiencies, and so forth. And so for the reasons that people create pools when they can, whether it's county-based purchasing or whatever, the idea of making sure that everyone has the opportunity for pools was part of the rationale behind this bill that we introduced. But there were some other concepts as well, and one of the concepts was that
The bill would allow for a fee-for-service model where the doctors, patients, and small businesses would be the doctors would be paid directly for the work that they did. And the concept there was that a lot of under the capitated payment system that we have today, we're paying a third party for an estimate of what the care is going to be to pay for a particular person. And then that third party has oversight responsibilities over how that care is delivered. And then we as a government have oversight responsibilities over that overseer in order to determine that they're actually delivering care and not just keeping the money back, because there's kind of an inherent conflict of interest in a capitated payment system that we have to be careful, because in most of these systems, if you deliver less care, you're going to get to keep more of the money. If you're nonprofit, you can justify that in terms of management, or you can hold it in reserves. If you're for-profit, then you can use it to enhance your profits. And so the idea was that this would be a different kind of a system where it would simplify the need for all of those administrative costs by going back to a more traditional fee-for-service type of model, where the need to have pre-approval for treatment would be eliminated, the need for a lot of oversight, and the opportunity for that third party to take a lot of the profit out of the system would be eliminated. It was also initially what we did was we created a bill that put together a study group to really dig down deeply into what we would want this pool to be. And we had business community participation, we had legislative appointees as well as gubernatorial. We had some of the unions have appointees, so consumer groups were represented. And then we also had doctors, and Dr. Ron Hansen is here with me today. He was one of two physicians who donated a tremendous amount of very valuable time to give us a physician's perspective about how our healthcare system works today, what works well for them, and what isn't working so well, where they thought we could not only enhance quality but identify some cost savers within the system and simplify the process and make it a more efficient as well as, I guess you could say, happier experience for the physicians and the patients as far as the whole process of how care is delivered. We met during the same time that the Healthcare Transformation Task Force was having their committee meetings that same summer. Must have had between 50 and 20 meetings. Ended up resulting in a report. And the copies of that report, I think, are in your packets. It's something that looks like this.
It is in the packets. It's your letterhead at the top, a letter from you to.
Right, a report to the chairs of legislative committee. That represents the work of this task force, and it goes through and outlines what the discussion was, the determinations were, and then there's an attachment of the bill, which was actually then introduced the following year. The biggest concern that we grappled with, aside from the fact that there were perhaps, I think it would be fair to say, some philosophical differences, there were some who just felt that when we ultimately got to the end of this process, we decided that the best way to administer and this payment structure would be through the formation of a co-op. And this co-op structure would consist of a board that was appointed in a three-way process. A third of the members would be appointed by the patients, the employees, the people who were actually covered under the system. Third, I believe it was, would be appointed by the business community who would be helping to pay the premiums, or I'm not sure if it was exactly a third, but a percentage. And then the other percentage would represent the medical community, physicians, nurses, and those who are operating within the system. And they, as a board, would help to be determining what the coverage was going to be. It would be responsible for determining the negotiations with the physicians over fees, and essentially just all the administrative responsibilities that would deal with this board. But there would be no third party, no insurance company, no health plan in acting as a middleman. This would be a very direct user-operated, user decision-making type of system. And so there were some who just didn't like the idea of that being available as an option for consumers because it would be competitive. And according to the estimates that we received in a lot of the testimony, we should be the thinking was that we could reduce overall costs for health care by anywhere from 10 to 15% on the conservative side to up to as much as 40% on the less conservative side, simply by eliminating all of these unnecessary steps and administrative requirements that are within our system today. But this was an optional pool. This is a pool where people could join or not as they chose. And so the biggest difficulty that we had as we went through this whole discussion was the idea that the way our insurance system works today, people can be refused coverage because of a health pre-existing health condition. And so the idea was, with that ability, sick people would come to us when they were sick and needed care and decide to enroll in our program because they wouldn't be able to get coverage elsewhere, or their rates would be higher elsewhere, and that those sick people would then kind of drown our pool and prevent it from being able to succeed. And that is called adverse selection, I guess, within the discussions of this. And so how we would deal with the problem of adverse selection was probably the most complicated and in-depth part of our discussion. And most of the people who ended up, or I guess almost all, of the dissent to anyone who disagreed with this approach was around that issue of adverse selection. We did have the majority of people who have participated decided that they would prefer to go forward with this in any case, because we did allow the board to have some parameters to decide to be able to address that issue of adverse selection, and that's discussed in greater detail in the report that I gave you. So, but for example, the idea was that we could bring in either large groups of people who were looking for a public pool as a way to get something started, or a cooperative model pool, or we could put certain things in place like definite days for coming in and going out that would eliminate to some degree the concern of adverse selection. The testimony that we had is once you got to a pool of about 50,000 people, then there was less of a concern that this was statistically not going to really have much of an impact. But in any event, we decided that we would allow some of this decision-making to take place by the board, because there would have to be a lot of cooperation with actuarials and things that we really weren't funded to do as a part of our committee study. Well, so we put the bill together. It was introduced for a variety of reasons. It didn't move forward. I think at that point we were moving forward with Senator Marty's bill as an option. But then, in lieu of the federal health care reform legislation, something that wasn't mentioned by the presentation we heard from Commerce but is a part of the health care exchange is a specific option to establish a co-op. And it's really kind of interesting that apparently the federal government got there at the same time that we as a state were having this same conversation a couple years earlier. And so I have the legislation. It's also in your materials in a summary of it where it says public plan or not-for-profit option. And this describes the parameters that we have as a state to include if we choose this co-op model as a part of the exchange. And it also states that there is federal money available for the startup cost to get the administration going to get this co-op model off the ground. And So that was pretty exciting news. Not only is it something that the federal government is encouraging, that we've already done the background work on in the state of Minnesota, and they're providing some of the startup money. That was one of our impediments, was because we would have had a fiscal note to move this thing forward. But also because the federal government has decided that we are not going to allow insurance companies to risk adjust people out any longer, we're not going to exclude people because of pre-existing conditions, the concern that we had over adverse selection was largely eliminated. And so that objection is really no longer a valid objection to moving forward with this idea because of the federal legislation changing the law in that regard. So with the combination of those circumstances, Senator Erickson Ropes and I decided to reintroduce this bill, making it contingent on going into effect when we would get our federal health care exchange up and running, and applying for and getting the federal money that would fund the startup costs to move forward with this idea. I also want to thank the University of Minnesota School of Public Health for doing an analysis of this bill after it was introduced in light of federal health care reform. And you'll see that with the Shadeck logo. And what the university did was go through and state essentially that there were three aspects of the federal law they felt were relevant, and that we would probably need to address in perhaps some further revision of the bill that we've introduced to make sure that we're conforming with federal legislation. We had an informal meeting to talk about this last week with some stakeholders who were interested in this. And the first of these is the requirement that we have to make sure that the plan would that the plans we'd introduce would be qualified with what's required on the exchange. The exchange specifically says that the plans have to meet certain parameters in terms of coverage. And it would be very simple to add some language to say that our co-op is going to meet the same benefit parameters as that would be required at the federal level. The second observation was that the law creates a program, it says, to encourage the development of consumer-oriented and operated plans, co-ops. They must be established as newly licensed nonprofit health insurance issuers, and they cannot be state or local government sponsored. In other words, these cannot be state-run health care programs. They have to be co-ops. Well, clearly, our plan is a co-op, not a state-run program. But there is some language in the bill that's just to get this board up and running and off the ground, where we had said the original initial board would be people who were appointed by the state simply to make decisions initially to get the thing going until these other members could be selected as I described. And there was some discussion about the fact that we might have to tweak that language a bit just to make sure, or even ask for clarification for the federal government to make sure that that little bit of connection with the state wouldn't somehow be in violation of federal parameters. And then the last observation was that initially the federal law restricts purchasing through the exchange to individuals and small employers, while our plan says that it would be open to anyone who wants to buy in. We can and choose to allow large employers to participate beginning in 2017. So again, that would require some revision to simply say that it's going to be restricted to individuals and small employers until 2017, or we could ask for a waiver depending on which way we decided we wanted to go. But again, kind of a technicality in terms of an ability certainly to just tweak the language a little bit in order to make sure that it complies. In summary, the letter from Julie Sonier states, although some provisions of the new federal health reform law are inconsistent with the plan that we considered, that's those things that are minor that I just explained, the law does not appear to specifically prohibit state-sponsored plans from being offered through the exchange as long as they meet all the requirements to be certified as a qualified plan. And I'm not even sure I would consider this a state-sponsored plan. As I said, the intent of the plan was very much to be a co-op.
there really isn't any state involvement other than just deciding we're going to do this and the state making the decision that we're going to have a co-op available as one of the options people would have on the exchange. The idea, frankly, though, is to look at some of the concepts we had for simplifying healthcare, making it more patient-friendly, giving some of the responsibility for making medical decisions back to the physician community. The medical community isn't just physicians. And by eliminating and all of that administration-related cost and time-consuming, confusing paperwork, and really coming back to a more traditional doctor-patient relationship that we believe we can actually save a lot of money. And by having this available as one of the options on the exchange, it will give the opportunity for people to make that choice. Certainly, if the savings are there that we anticipate, it may very well turn out to be a model that other health plans might find to their detriment, but only because it offers better coverage at a lower price. And if our true goal is to try to make sure that our constituents have available to them highest quality care at the lowest cost, this will provide that option for them. So with that, you know, again, this report is fairly long, but if you have the time to read this, I think it will help to explain better the idea and the concept. The idea this year, I think, though, was simply to try to lay this out for this committee, make you aware of this rather than asking to move forward this year, because it does appear that there won't be an exchange up and running certainly before next legislative session, and that we are going to try to do some work to make sure that these changes suggested are incorporated, as well as hearing from other stakeholders over the interim and perhaps incorporating additional language or suggestions they may have. So with that, I would very much appreciate it if you would give Dr.
Sure. We'll have Dr. Hansen, and then Mr. Griffin wanted to speak briefly to it. And we, I hope we can keep it fairly brief because we have the other bill. We want to at least present that idea as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dr. Ronell Hansen. I am a radiologist with St. Paul Radiology here, so I'm a private practice subspecialist. I should note that although I was one of the two physicians on the committee, we also had an employed primary care physician, Dr. James Young, who spent an awful lot of time helping the committee. So we really did have the perspectives of people providing not only some specialty care, but those in an employed model within the Twin Cities, as well as those within private practice. I am immediate past president of the Twin Cities Medical Society. I was part of this committee, and I'm also part of the MMA Legislative Committee and the Twin Cities Medical Society Public Policy Committee. And so I follow a lot of healthcare policy, both on the state and national level. I think one of the things that is significant about this particular set of ideas is that the examination of the problem was extensive. I think we looked at this for almost 8 months, and a lot of the conclusions derived from our assessment from professionals largely came from the industry itself. These were insurance professionals that came to us. They explained to us how risk adjustment was performed, where costs go. And we really had input from a spectrum of both the ideologic and philosophic points of view, conservatives, single-payer advocates, and even those who are more liberal ideas. So I think that this is really an amalgam of a sophisticated assessment and a fairly comprehensive one. I think one of the things that physicians always think is, you know, how is it that anything that we come up with is a solution that puts more obstacles between me and my patients? And although I am certainly intrigued by federal health care legislation and things that we come up in the state, it seems that for those of us who actually see the patients, everything we seem to do creates more and more overhead and cost and administrative burden on everything we seek to do, and we become further and further and further removed from our patients. this not only generates a tremendous amount of cost and a tremendous amount of stuff which is non-productive, but, I mean, in truth, you know, we're sort of working faster than we have ever worked for less than we have ever worked, and we're seeing the patients less. I mean, at St. Joe's, before I can even touch a patient, I have to fill out 8 pieces of paper, okay? And I mean, it can take me longer to fill out those pieces of paper than it is to see my patient, talk to my patient, put hands on my patient, and do anything productive. So I think for anyone who is trying to assess healthcare legislation who has never actually walked into a clinic or watched how healthcare is delivered, the value of seeing how something is actually done versus talking about it in the abstract form or theoretically, I cannot overstress the importance of watching how something is actually done. And that's why we, as physicians, very much appreciate the opportunity to have input. I appreciate Senator Rolson asking me to come here. I can certainly go on at length about, you know, what we do if people have specific questions, but I will say that I think that the whole concept behind this was to look at ways that have been successfully done on large corporate structure in order to reduce overhead costs of third-party payers and administration and bring back the patient-physician relationship and the physicians and the way we provide care back to the table.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just glancing at your report, Senator Olson, you know, I see two things that just kind of jumped out at me that you weren't able to get specific on potential participation nor cost savings. And did you not go down those roads very far, or did you get bogged down in trying to determine that? Or, you know, if we're going to move in another direction or in those are two things we should know, I think. It would be problematic for me to move down a new healthcare road if there weren't cost savings. And since that was not, it didn't look like it was identified in your report, and I'm just glancing at it. But did you go into that very deep?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, actually, we spent a lot of time talking about that issue. There, I think what the comment you're referring to was in one particular letter that was from the, remember her name anymore.
Minnesota Business
Institute.
Partnership. Or
right.
Partnership. Yeah.
That was her comment, and I would just have to frankly say that I think it was a bit misleading in the sense that until we had this pool up and running, that was one of the charges of the board, was to determine who and to make this available to people and know what number there would be. But the reason there was the concern around the number was because of the risk the adverse selection issue. And so I know just anecdotally last week when we were talking about this informally, there was a woman who came just because she was interested, and she said, well, I'm a small business owner, and this is surely something I'd like to do. Whenever you have a cooperative model and something where people have more direct control over how the money is spent, as we do with most co-ops, I think that's something that Minnesotans understand and like. But it would take actually putting this together, because it's something different, to have a better idea, unless as a state we decided to bring in particular groups, and then we'd have to work with those groups, and we wouldn't force anyone in, but if they wanted to, then we could have it would be much easier to quantify what the number would be. The question about cost savings, well, we didn't have the funding with our group to be able to say to an exact number what the money would be that would be saved. As I told you, I think the estimates were anywhere from 40% of what we're spending on healthcare to between 15 and 40%. But I can only say that even if it's on the conservative end and we're talking about 15%, that's a lot of money.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Olson, for presenting the bill. I think to other members, what initially brought me to this idea about trying to create something was I have so many self-employed people in my district and farmers and people that are outside of pools. Excuse me. They have nowhere to go. And they tell me all the time it's like shopping with the sharks to try to find affordable health care. They can't do it. And a lot of my constituents are just have no coverage or have to pay huge rates. And I think the rates have been pretty well documented that farmers almost pay two times as much for their health care coverage as any other group because they have no large group to go to. So when I came here, I was really committed to trying to find a mechanism to create a pool that all these singletons could just jump into and get some sort of decent coverage. And, of course, you know, the big problem was adverse selection, unless it was a mandatory pool. And we didn't want to do that and couldn't do that. So now that the adverse selection piece has been taken away through federal health care reform, this is a building block that I think was really well done a few years ago, and we knew it wasn't going to advance, you know, but it was a building block, and we had it ready, and we just got it all taken care of and tucked it away because we knew there'd be a day come when we're talking about health care reform, we can pull this out. And I think it's a perfect fit right now for where the feds want to go with health care reform. They're talking about co-ops. They're talking about this insurance exchange. And let's put it out there as one of the choices for people in Minnesota.
Senator Sharon.
I have a couple of questions. I'm trying to run the memory bank going on this a little bit, Senator Olson, but would you remind me, my understanding of this concept is that there's no public money involved in this program. The public dollars are not the startup. How does this process, which really is a public option, where the general public can get in the pool, but you're not talking about, this is a question, I'm making it a declarative statement, but I think it's really a question. The state is not putting up the money to cover the losses, you know, where you have to put in a set of money in order to make sure that those who are drawing down benefits, that there's money in the pool to pay for those benefits. How does that get funded on the front end? And if you use a fee-for-service concept, can I assume that this board that manages it, it's sort of like in Germany, they have a statutory form, and they have a committee very similar to this that's made up, that has pharmaceutical companies on it, by the way, you might think about that, represent all the players, and they have this pool of money, and they have to decide how that's going to be distributed by this board. There's that boundary about money and about cost savings is set by the amount of money that comes into the pool by its membership. So that's there's no going to the taxpayers and asking for more money. They live and operate within the efficiency of their own system and the fees that, and people can choose to join it or not, depending on how expensive it is, and it competes on that basis, eliminating those administrative costs that you have in other systems of HMOs. So my question is, am I correct in my memory that setting up that set of resources that covers the risk, how is that accomplished in this new model? And am I accurate in saying that the boundary that this board operates within is the revenue that's earned from the fees that they collect from the members? And then it's distributed by that board, so as the physicians negotiate their fees or the costs of drugs are negotiated or all of those elements of payment, which have to be cost-contained, are negotiated by this board.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, thank you very much for that question because it seems to me like you've got a very good handle on, you know, by comparing what you described in Germany, very much what this could look like. In terms of there will be costs, just administrative costs to sit down and put this together, you know, to determine, to do all the background work, the software work, the actuarial work, the marketing work, to set up essentially a co-op health plan. And my understanding is that the funds to help get that going are going to be available through the federal government, and that would be the money that we're applying for in the in terms of actually having the money available to pay the claims that will come in, the premiums are going to pay the claims, and just like they would in any other health plan, but there's always a requirement that you have some protection so that if you've if claims are coming in ahead of premium payments, or that you've got, you know, something that was unanticipated, or, you know, it's never just 100% level. Sometimes you have catastrophic injuries or whatever. Then initially at the beginning, you're going to have a portion, you're going to have to purchase stop loss coverage. And the cost of that stop loss coverage is going to end up getting built into your premium cost until you've had enough time go by that you've been able to build up sufficient reserves. Now, there isn't a lot of discussion about this in the bill because, frankly, the idea, and we did talk in detail about all of this in our committee meetings, but we decided that rather than overly legislating how this pool was going to be done, that you would be better off charging this board with making the detailed determinations of how to make sure that this was sound. But definitely they're going to have to follow the same consumer protection types of regulations that we have in commerce, as well as consumer protections that any other insurance plan would have to follow, and that's specifically in the bill. Does that answer your question?
Do you know how much, one final question, how much money is the federal grant putting aside for starting up these co-ops? I mean, what's Minnesota's share?
Mr. Chair, I have the actual bill, federal health care bill language, and perhaps someone can from Commerce can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure if there's a particular share allocated to Minnesota. I think it's overall pool of money. I mean, it isn't assumed that every state's going to do this. And so,
Mr. Chair, I think that's part of the point about us hearing these bills early and trying to get ahead of the other 49 states.
So we could get money.
Get in line.
I can find out, too, from health department or whoever on the mouth, but yeah. Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Griffin wanted to speak with the concern about the bill, unless there are any more questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Phil Griffin speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And Mr. Chairman, I haven't had a chance to talk with Senator Olson about the newly introduced bill, but we have testified on the previous bill, and I just want to be on the record to raise some of the concerns with the issues that the committee members have heard about today. The federal share of money that will be coming through was yet to be determined, as I understand it. This is one of, as I saw it, 104 pages of demonstration projects that are available in the federal bill, many of which are going to be determined by the Secretary as she continues her work to try and figure out where health care reform goes. And so as the members of this committee look at this bill, we would urge caution. The questions of how much reserves are going to be, we think, are spelled out very clearly in statute currently for health plans and insurance companies, and we would not want to see anything less than that for new entities that are reformed like this. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that we're doing an informational hearing today and that we have a lot of other things going on, including an omnibus health and human services bill that's in the Senate Finance Committee right now and on the floor of the House right now, so I don't want to take a lot of your time, but we would urge caution. I don't want to say that we're in the position of opposing the bill, but we do have plans that currently are doing the kinds of things that are suggested here, and as we described to the committee previously, we think that some of the savings that are projected from moving to a direct contract type of system are not going to be realized and therefore put the people who are on such a plan in jeopardy in the future. Mr. Chairman, PPACA is an incredibly complex piece of legislation, and I don't think that anyone who's foolish enough to say that PPACA is going to resolve all of the problems that we have in health care has really looked at what we have got going on in front of us. The real key that we have been talking to you as legislators about relates to the issues of how are we going to control the growing costs of health care. PPACA's main goal has been to try and expand coverage, and it has done an incredible job of that, but it will take a number of years before it goes into complete effect. We look forward to working with you and trying to resolve the numerous problems that it will create as well as the opportunities that it will give us. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, if there are other questions, I'd be happy to address it.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Senator Olson. Senator Erickson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And in response to that, I would just simply say that this is one area, as with the other pilot projects that states can engage in, where the federal government is giving us the opportunity to address exactly what was just stated, the ability to save cost. Now, I'm kind of guessing, although I would love to see the health plans on board with supporting this, but considering it would be a direct competitor with the health plans, I would be very surprised if they would be encouraging competition, but that doesn't mean that it isn't a better thing for consumers. And so, you know, again, it's an option. We're asking just to compete, to look at federal funds to get this off the ground, so we're not asking for state money. Other states are going to take that money if we're not taking it. And we had a lot of testimony that said we could be saving consumers a lot of money on for their health coverage. So I would love to see the health plans cooperate with us in basically having that kind of competition. And we also heard from the medical community that this would be something that would help them do their jobs in a more effective way.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Griffin, I just have a really quick yes or no question. Would this bill, if it's turned into a product, would this product be in competition with the health plans you represent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
Just a quick question. What do you calculate your administrative costs to be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, when you say you, do you mean my individual clients or the health plans as a whole or the insurance industry? Those numbers vary dramatically.
Aren't you with Preferred One, or you spoke on behalf of Preferred One?
I was speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, but okay. I do represent both Preferred One and UCARE.
So either one or both.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, for Preferred One, they are slightly over 10%. As a smaller health plan, our administrative expenses are higher than larger health plans.
And the other?
The other client?
Yes.
UCARE? Off the top of my head, I can't say, Senator, but I would be happy to check with you. But because they are in government programs only, their administrative expenses on the state programs are regulated and, under the cap that the Department of Human Services negotiates with them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson, last comment on the bill.
Okay, just a quick follow-up to Senator Sharon's comment. But then we have seen when we dig a little deeper that a lot of things like even the cost of reinsurance is called a medical cost. The cost of pre-approval is called a medical cost, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not things that we would have that we would have to pay for under this kind of program. There would also be a reduction on the provider side of having to deal with all of these things, and that also is a part of the health cost. This is only the plan's administrative costs. We would also be reducing administrative costs on the provider side.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't know that I would necessarily agree with the analysis, but I look forward to the continued debate and work with Senator Olson.
Thank you all.
And I hope to surprise her at some point in time.
And we have very quickly Senator Erickson Hopes wanted 7 or 10 minutes to present her bill, which comes from Minsky, apparently, and project could save us money in nursing education. Mm-hmm. Senate File 3397, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, that it still survived. Thank you. This is just a quick idea that we wanted to present to you this afternoon because of all the opportunities that are available for grant money from the federal health care reform. In fact, in the presentation from the two departments earlier, I will refer you to the page there that's called Other Public Health Issues. And one of the things they reviewed for us in the workforce there is that the National Healthcare Workforce Commission was established to review some healthcare workforce needs. And there are going to be various loans and grant opportunities available for states to increase the supply of health care and public health workers. We all know in Minnesota that we have a shortage. I think Mankato State did an excellent review and brief piece on the health care worker shortage. So we know the money is out there now in the federal health care reform. And those states that get their act together and get lined up first and get really good projects presented out to the feds are going to be the ones that capture that grant money. So having said that, I ran into Liz Beal, who actually lives in my district, but she is an employee of MNSCU, and she explained the clinical care coordination or the clinical coordination project to me, and it's very exciting because she works with many, 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 many hospitals and clinics in the metro area, and she works with many, 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 many RN education programs through the colleges, and she's trying to find work sites and clinical settings for all those nursing students to go out and get clinical experience. And it was just a real headache, I think, for the educators and for the clinical sites. So they hired Liz to say, help us make some sense out of all this scheduling. And with that as an intro, I will turn it over to Liz to explain just for 3 to 5 minutes about what happened, what the problem was, how she solved it, and where we can go from here.
Thank you, Senator Oaks. Thank you, Chairman and Senators. I'm very excited to be here today. The Clinical Coordination Project actually came out of a pilot.
You have to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Elizabeth Beal, and I work at MNSCU, and I specialize in healthcare education industry partnerships to help solve all the issues with the healthcare workforce shortage. The clinical coordination project actually came out of a pilot, and the pilot was conducted between 14 mid to large hospitals and 10 education programs. In the metro, it was all Allina, which is our largest healthcare system, and it was also in the Winona La Crosse area, which also helps provide a lot of clinical space for Minnesota students. We just were able in March to report on a year after the pilot, so we can compare before the pilot and then after the pilot, and we had very significant positive outcomes. I mean, this is a big issue that's been affecting healthcare for a long time, and it's the first time we've actually chipped away at the problem. And also very excited that these outcomes can realistically be expanded throughout the state. We've already received a significant interest, and we're confident that we can help benefit the state because all the solutions or all the outcomes were solutions to problems that those that experienced the problems were involved in fixing them. It addresses clinical education experiences, the hands-on experiences that all healthcare, especially direct care students, have to complete in order to sit for their boards so they can be hired after graduation. Because healthcare is so highly regulated, and also because these students have to conduct so much experiences during that time, those experiences aren't like, say, a business program, but they're set up by the school between the healthcare provider. The problem that's been faced is these resources are hard to schedule. A typical nursing program works between 7 to 8 other clinical providers, which are usually hospitals. And also, the current space that they have is either being oftentimes diminished, or when they want to expand, they can't expand. And what this means, because what this means is, without additional clinical space, our nursing programs can't expand. And also, in times when their space is diminished, that unless they can find replacement space, then their student numbers go down. So we started this pilot, and first, when we looked at the pilot, our target was capacity because we thought we need to find more spots. But what we discovered is this is only a byproduct, or it's one side of the coin. We really looked at why is it that education programs are getting the feedback that they can't provide as much, or we can't expand. And what we found on that side is that the clinical partners is very highly confusing, and it's very inefficient. For example, my pilot participants evaluated that it takes them 60 minutes per rotation to schedule, negotiate, and track their clinicals per rotation. That same hospital did 377 rotations last year. See, it's just, it's an administrative headache. And why why is it the way it is? Well, mainly every single clinical partner I've talked to and every single education partner I've talked to has said, well, that's because that's the way it's always been done. And the way that it's always been done worked, you know, initially, but now we're a lot more complex. Both we're putting in a lot more students, both through the nursing programs and also through these clinical sites. And also, as everyone knows, we're continually trying to do more with less. So what is always done before typically looks like is that the key players, not only the industry partners and the education partners, aren't coming together to help solve this issue, but not all the education partners. They're all dying for the same space, but they're not all coming together. Likewise, all the people that have the space, clinical partners, they're not coming together. Everybody's working independently and differently. So what that means is, I know we have about 38 nursing schools in the state. They're all doing it differently. They're collecting their data differently. They're using that data differently, just like every single clinical partner is collecting and using that data differently. That can easily quantify to 65 different methods throughout the state of doing the same thing when everybody wants the same thing, either provide clinicals or have the capacity or the healthcare workforce afterwards to hire them. So what did we do to turn this around within our project? Basically, what we did is we developed a partnership, and often this is the first time all education partners, two-year, four-year, U of M, MinSCU, proprietary, and also private, come together to all work on this issue along with their clinical partners. So we tore down all those silos and those barriers. Also, all those 65 different ways of collecting and utilizing that data, we standardized it into one easy-to-quantify and use database. And we also made things centralized and very transparent. So right then and there, we were increasing efficiencies. We also standardized how everybody uses the data. Like, for instance, education partners were telling clinical partners, it's very difficult for us to plan for our students when we don't find out what our capacity is going to be until May. Well, clinical partners replied, well, that's usually because we don't get your requests till middle of April. If you get us your request by May 5th, we'll commit to having our decisions to most of that data by April 9th. We just went through this for fall 2010 planning with our pilot. So now all that information is available April 9th, and those little changes that are needed, they don't have to be done in such a highly chaotic, confusing manner all at the last minute. Now we've got a whole month before education programs are going out that they can handle those slight changes. Excuse me. Another thing that we also do is we always try to keep our finger on what the pulse is of what's going on with clinical, both on the clinical side and the education side, because it's so interrelated. For instance, to say Winona State changes their curriculum and their needs, that's going to affect 10 different hospitals. Likewise, if Abbott Northwestern changes, a unit goes down, that could very likely affect 10 different education programs. So we try to be proactive versus reactive by always evaluating, always talking to these people, understanding what's going to go on, and try to prevent that snowball before it happens. We, like I said, we just had our evaluation from before TCCP to after, and we came up with our evaluation results in March. And what we found is we're able to show on the clinical partner side is how the pilot's rolled out is we get an entire clinical partner on, and then we invite the education partners as the clinical partners work with them. And what we found for clinical partners, that they were able to save a significant amount of time, which equals into money. For instance, that 60 minutes per rotation, we were able to get that down to 15 minutes. So now they can spend that time that they used to with all the inefficiencies, all the back and forth on other essential services. That's just the monetary savings. There's also other benefits that are hard to quantify but are just as important. Number one is the data. Now that we have all the standardized data, we're able to, for the first time, to see what actually the activity is, who's already busy, and where there's areas that we can expand. And plus, we're all talking the same language. Before, when we were all 65, it's almost like we're having 65 languages going on, and nobody understands each other. Now that we're all talking apples to apples, now it just opens it up to the possibilities of how we can fix this problem. Also, the partnership. In my evaluation, I asked them about whether or not they thought the working partnership that we always meet was a good idea. And also I asked them if this work was beneficial to their personal clinical coordination work. And for 100% of those, I found yes, it helps me out because it gives me the support I need. When I ask education programs, how would you tell your leadership why I should be involved at this? They said, because it provides me the tools so that I could find the clinical needs that I have today, and it also gives me the foundation so I can expand in the future. And to me, that's hard to quantify with numbers, but it's a significant benefit. This is something that I can go through in like a 20-minute presentation. I know that in the interest of time, I'm just kind of going through it. So I guess I'd like to stop and see if there's any questions that I can go through any details further.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Erickson-Ropes.
Just to add, if you would, do you have the presentation papers?
I do not think we do. We will get that to people. We should get that to other members who might be interested.
On the back page there, you'll see a long list of healthcare providers and a long list of the nursing, the colleges and universities that have nursing programs, and then the laboratories that are participating. And so you get some idea when she talks about 65 different ways of doing things. If you look on that last page there, you'll see all the participants. And you can just imagine that by streamlining the way all of these people talk and interact to with each other into a standard system, that one of the other benefits that Liz has discovered is that sometimes the healthcare providers, like a particular hospital, might say, we can't handle any more students. We're at capacity right now. We can't place those students anywhere else in our units. Now they're finding out that, they do have a couple extra slots during the week. Capacity has opened up a little bit. And this ties in, again, to our federal initiative that's looking at ways to increase the supply of health care and public health workers. One of the bottlenecks that we know exists at the education level in colleges is that they don't have enough clinical sites to get more students out the door. This is going to streamline that process and open up more capacity for pumping more healthcare workers out there. So I think it's just got great potential. And again, Minsky had identified this problem, hired her to work with all of those stakeholders you see there. But just imagine, members, this only deals with nurses. We could use this same program for physical therapists, for CNAs. There's a lot more certified nursing assistants out there than registered nurses. We're trying to get more CNAs trained and out to nursing homes and out to community-based settings. So if we could use this same model across the healthcare workforce spectrum, just imagine what might happen. So I think it's really a great idea. The bill is presented to you in a way for an appropriation next year to continue the funding through MNSCU, but that may not be the way we decide to go. I just put this together for this bill. But we also want to consider this program as an opportunity perhaps tee up as a state to, kick out to the feds to qualify for some of those federal loans. So,
Ms. Beale, how many more slots has this opened up, noticeably more slots to the schools?
Well, one of the things that we realized that we really targeted the inefficiencies. If we were able to make it more efficient and easy as possible for clinical partners to provide more space and also for education providers to find the space that they need, if we can get them the space that they need, then the capacity takes care of itself. We don't just make space that's not going to be used. We try to always make sure that all the programs have what they need. And we've always been able to do that.
Because I think that one of the problems of the whole healthcare system is nobody's in charge of making these simple things happen. I mean, why we produce so many specialists in terms of medical school instead of general practitioners? Well, the schools do it because the students have so much debt, they figure it's a more profitable way to practice medicine. But there's nobody in charge saying, well, that's not what we need in the system. We could buy down the tuition costs for the general practitioners, and nobody's in charge of making sure they have the clinical settings for the schools. And by putting it together this way, you're saying that one woman said that there was an hour of prep time each time just to prepare for each shift, and now it's down to 15 minutes. Senator Sharon.
Yeah, I don't think that this process addresses the issue you have about the overall decision making about where the state invests money for healthcare workers, so that it's directed
properly. But this is one part of it. Yeah.
This really deals with, if I'm a nursing faculty member, I have to cover 8 to 10 students in a mental health facility in Mankato. I'm from Minnesota State Mankato. I can't find a clinical site to put those 10 students to do the clinical hours that are required for them to meet the licensure requirements. This system, and that's one division of several in the School of Nursing in Mankato, times as many schools of nursing as there are throughout the state, and there are only so many hospitals that can accommodate us 24 hours a day. This person is coordinating that. And between all the schools of nursing, all the potential clinical facilities. But it's not for all the schools of nursing. That's a pilot project that's only covering a certain group of people right now.
Well, we've expanded. Our pilot was smaller, but within the last year when we were after the pilot, we did double our education partnership, and that's on the back.
And who is paying for this now?
We're paid for a variety of creative streams. We've secured some funding from the Department of Labor grant. We've got some funding from Health Force Minnesota, which is underneath Minsky, also the Healthcare Education Industry Partnership. And we've gotten in-kind funding from our clinical partners.
And Senator Sharon, your students, your Minnesota State Mankato could take more students. I mean, you could open the program up. The stumbling block at yours is, one, difficulty of recruiting faculty, and two, getting students
into programs. I can't find a clinical site.
Those
on
are the
days
two biggest
that,
obstacles.
Yeah, you know, my day has got classroom. Minnesota State Mankato sets Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays required classroom days. So the only days I have are Tuesdays and Thursdays to do clinicals.
Yeah.
Now I have to go out and compete with every other university in the system who's training nurses for clinical sites on Tuesday and Thursday, and say Cates wants to be there, and the university wants to be there, and Gustavus wants to be there, and we're all fighting for the same mental health units through the state, of which there are fewer and fewer because we're cutting funding for mental health. And that's the problem. And in this administrative time, is my administrative time as a faculty member trying to find clinical sites? And that hospital talking to all of us clinical instructors trying to find clinical sites, and on the phone all the time saying, what day was that, and what hours, and how many, and what? And and that is what this is trying to systematize, which I think is a fabulous
idea.
Mr. Chair, that's also why it's really difficult to create a piece like this, because we can see why it's a benefit to the university system or Minsky system or the educational colleges. But they aren't willing to pay for her to do that. And actually, the healthcare providers, all of those hospitals you see listed on the back, they have to spend a lot less administrative time now with this. So they're benefiting, but they don't benefit to the extent that they want to pay for one person to do this whole project. And it comes down to, it just never gets done because everybody's working frantically in their own silos. So what Liz's program does is actually create a bridge that goes from the silos of the healthcare providers to the silos of the educational nursing programs to the students and connects everybody together. I think it's
very
it's
impressive. Yeah.
A good idea.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all. Is there any other questions? If not, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And with that, this joint committee meeting is adjourned.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Yeah. Oh, no, yes. Well, I tried to die.